been a busy week for Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks. Apart from the withdrawal and equally sudden reinstatement of the sexual molestation case from Sweden, I now learn there's a new site, WikiLeaksy.org, specifically dedicated to leaks about WikiLeaks. Anyway, here's some history from Stephen Kinzer, slightly less controversial than Webster Tarkley. Here's a 2003 speech about the CIA's first coup d'etat in Tehran.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. Really, this is a wonderful opportunity. Now, as I was going through the museum, having been fortunate enough to show up a few minutes early, I noticed a fascinating item in one of the display cases. It's a statue from the 7th or 8th century that shows a Chinese figure playing polo. I come from Massachusetts, and I thought blue bloods from New England and England were all the people that ever played polo. So I read the card, and sure enough, it says that polo was introduced to China in the 7th century from Iran. This is just one little clue of the influence that this great culture has had on the world. I was living in Istanbul for several years, and I was the New York Times correspondent there. Iran was not part of my beat. But one day I got a phone call out of the clear blue from my office in New York, and because of some problems of people not being able to do something or not being able to get visas, I had to go to Iran to cover the presidential election campaign. That was the campaign that brought President Khatami to office. So I had a chance to go to Iran, which was a thrilling experience, but Iran not being part of my real beat, I was unprepared. I hadn't studied Iran the way that I had studied the countries to which I had been assigned. Now, Iran is, of course, a part of the Middle East, and I have a certain stereotype that I think is probably typical of many people who have only a vague idea about the Middle East, and that is that the countries of the Middle East are really fake countries. These countries don't have any long traditions or history. They were all invented by a couple of British aristocrats in men's clubs who just drew lines on maps. There's no historic Jordan or Yemen or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia or Iraq. These are all countries that just were created for political necessity by the British in the early part of the 20th century. And I arrived in Iran with the vague idea that Iran must be another country like this. It didn't take very long, on the first day, really, for me to realize that Iran has nothing to do with these invented countries of the Middle East. The Persian civilization is really one of the oldest and deepest and most creative civilizations in all of human history. And the chance to recognize this, to immerse myself in this, really set me off on the path that ultimately produced this book. 50 years ago this summer, actually it was August 19th, 1953, 28th of Mordad, by the Persian calendar, the CIA overthrew a government for the first time. It's hard for us to imagine, knowing what we know about regime change and covert action in the CIA now, that there was a time when the CIA was not thought of as an organization that should be involved in overthrowing regimes. That it should have only been an intelligence agency supposed to provide information for the foreign policy organs of the United States. This coup set the United States off on the path of covert action and regime change. And every government that we have overthrown or tried to overthrow in the 50 years since then has been the victim of a process that began with the intervention of 1953 in Iran. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the background of this operation, and then how it was carried out, and what its effects have been, because there is no better lesson in the 20th century history of the United States, and I say this as one who has immersed myself in this history, that teaches us so clearly about the unintended long-term effects of our interventions abroad than this operation. I wrote this book with the idea that I was going to tell a story that on the one hand was profoundly important in shaping the history of the United States, the history of Iran, and really the history of the world, but an episode that has been largely forgotten. Really, most Americans and most people in the world, even those that are interested in international affairs, have only the vaguest idea that this thing ever happened, much less that it had such a profound effect on shaping the whole Cold War and post-Cold War world. But as I was writing it, I slowly took on what I thought was a complementary but somewhat different mission. I realized that I wasn't just telling the story of a particular episode that was very important but had been lost to history. But in addition to that, I was resurrecting the figure of a man who in the mid-20th century was one of the most famous, most debated, most controversial, most fascinating, most interesting people in the world, but who today is almost completely unknown. And that is Mohammad Mossadegh, the nationalist leader who was the victim of the 1953 coup. In the mid-century, Mossadegh shook the world and challenged the system that had dominated the world for centuries. And in 1951, in recognition of his huge impact on the world, Time magazine named Mohammad Mossadegh as its Man of the Year, which meant that in the first issue of Time magazine in January of 1952, Mossadegh appeared on the cover of Time magazine. Actually, he beat out for the honor of Man of the Year 1951 Douglas MacArthur, Winston Churchill, Dwight Eisenhower, and Harry Truman. And in those days, Time magazine was actually making good choices. Mossadegh was more important in that year than any of those great figures with whom we are today so familiar. It made me realize that in addition to telling a story that has been more or less lost to history, I also had the chance to resurrect this great and most fascinating figure and present him to generations, not just in the United States, but really around the world, including in Iran, who don't know about him anymore, and for a variety of reasons have forgotten how important he was and how he shook the world that had existed for centuries before he, with his audacity, shook it and brought down some of its principal pillars. Mohammad Mossadegh was truly a unique and original historical figure. By the time he came to power in 1951, Mossadegh was already elderly. He had had a political career in the 1920s and 30s, but when the dictatorship of Reza Shah emerged, he was excluded from parliament. He went back to his village. Most people assumed that his political life was over, and I believe he assumed that himself. He had no idea that he would ever come back, but decades later, really, Iran became a democracy. Reza Shah was overthrown. He was sent off to exile in South Africa. And Iran resumed its march toward democracy. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, the ideology of nationalism, of anti-colonialism, was surging through the developing world. All the countries of Asia, Latin America, and Africa were looking at the structures that dominated them in ways they had never examined before. Now, bear in mind, this was a time when the voice of poor countries had really never been raised in the councils of the great powers. This was a period before Castro and Nkrumah and Nasser and Sukarno. Mossadegh was treading completely new territory. Nobody had ever done what he did. Mossadegh had two great principles. His entire political career was shaped by two ideas. The first idea was democracy. Mossadegh was a very sophisticated intellectual. He actually came from the royal family that had ruled Iran for several centuries up until the beginning of the 20th century. He was educated in France and Switzerland. He spoke fluent French, which was the language he used in his international travels. And when he emerged as a political figure in the late 1940s in Iran, he had the idea that he would try to bring Iran onto the path of democracy. In fact, as I will point out later on, his embrace of democracy was so profound and so deep and so sincere that it really bordered on the naive. He was so willing to tolerate opposition that he didn't even want to crack down when the CIA and other enemies in the pay of foreign forces were demonstrating and protesting and arranging his overthrow. So democracy was his first platform. His other great dream was to establish Iranian control over Iran. Now, from the perspective of today, this doesn't sound so radical. But looking at the history of Iran, this was as dramatic a change as that country could ever have contemplated. Iran had always been a country, or for centuries before Mossadegh came to power, that had been divided between Russian influence and British influence. After the Bolshevik Revolution, Lenin actually made a wonderful gesture to Iran. He canceled all the debts that Iran had accumulated to Russia during the Tsarist years. And Russia more or less withdrew its influence from Iran. Therefore, Britain was the principal colonial power there. And Britain exercised its power not just by manipulating politics, imposing prime ministers, deposing those that it didn't like, but Britain also had a much more important lever. The most powerful, richest, and largest British enterprise in the entire world was the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. This company, through the expedient of bribing Iranian negotiators in the early years of the 20th century, had achieved a fantastically lucrative monopoly on the extraction of Iranian oil. Winston Churchill, as the first Lord of the Admiralty in the early part of the 20th century, was the one who pushed this along with a number of other British leaders. Winston Churchill knew as World War I was breaking out that oil was going to determine who was going to win this war. That oil, not coal, was going to start powering warships. But Britain had no oil, and no country that Britain controlled, and no British colony produced any oil. When Churchill realized the scope of what was available in Iran and saw the terms by which Britain was now going to be able to extract all that oil, use it for the British Navy, to raise the standard of living in Britain, and then to earn huge amounts of foreign exchange from the sale of oil all over the world, he described it in a wonderful phrase as a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. The role that it played in the world during the 1920s and 30s and 40s, had it not been for the fantastic wealth that it sucked from under the deserts of Iran. Therefore, when Mossadegh arrived on the political scene with the platform of nationalism, which inevitably to every Iranian meant taking back our oil, he posed a profound challenge to what was then the governing world system and the system that had existed almost without challenge, literally for centuries. Actually, the way Mossadegh came to become prime minister is a fascinating story. Iran was a parliamentary democracy at that time, meaning that the parliament, elected by the people, would choose the prime minister from among its own members. At this time, the system was that the Shah, who was, according to the constitution, supposed to rule as a constitutional monarch, like the Queen of England, would nominate a candidate for prime minister, and the Majlis, the Iranian parliament, would debate and decide whether this member of parliament was the right person to become prime minister. Well, the Shah in 1951 had appointed one loyal, faithful member of parliament to become prime minister, and the parliament had to debate his nomination. Everyone expected that the first speaker would be Mossadegh, and that he would stand up and condemn this nominee as another lackey of the British, and another turncoat, another traitor to Iran, who didn't want democracy or freedom or self-determination. But Mossadegh didn't stand up. When the debate began, he remained seated, made no effort to make a talk. Another member of parliament stood up. I discovered during my research that he happened to have been on the payroll of the British intelligence service at this time. And this is what he said in his speech. He didn't speak about the nominee for prime minister at all. He spoke about the one person who was the most dominant, most forceful figure in all of Iranian politics. That was Mossadegh. And he pointed to him and said, "You are just one of those windbags who always protests, always criticizes from the outside, and never wants to take any responsibility. You are the example of what is wrong with our country and every developing country. All you want to do is criticize when people like the British are actually producing money, enterprises, and starting the kinds of businesses that make countries productive. You are the example of everything that is wrong with Iran. If you would become prime minister, you would see how difficult it is to deal with the whole world and all of Iran's problems. But you don't want to do that. You only want to criticize, as you have been doing ever since you were elected." This deputy then sat down, and another period of silence fell over the Majlis. Mossadegh then rose slowly from his chair. He took the microphone and said, "Thank you so much for the confidence you have expressed in me by nominating me for prime minister, and I accept." The entire parliament went into pandemonium. Within 1 hour, Mossadegh had been elected prime minister of Iran. Sensing the power that he had at that moment, he came back to the microphone and said, "I've decided there's one condition to my accepting the post. Before I accept, I want the Majlis to approve this bill I have proposed mandating the nationalization of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company." That bill was passed immediately. And the next day, Mossadegh became prime minister with the unanimous vote of parliament in favor of his resolution to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Now, the process by which he hoped to nationalize it was very interesting. He went to the British and told them, "We're nationalizing your oil company, and we're going to do it according to British law." At this moment, remember, Britain was nationalizing its own strategic industries. They nationalized the coal industry, the steel industry, the transport industry. And the law by which these nationalizations were carried out was very complicated. It allowed both parties, the nationalizer and the one being nationalized, to present their claims for how much money they had spent and how much money they believed they were owed. And it provided for a process by which these claims would be weighed, and it would be decided who owed who money and how much it would be. So Mossadegh really very cleverly embraced what was at that time British law. He didn't realize that, in the words of one British official, I quote in my book, "Socialism is all right back home, but out here you have to have a strong hand." Now, how did the British react to this profound, really earth-shattering challenge to their hegemony in Iran? First, they reacted with disbelief. This had never happened before, and the British could not believe that some elderly lunatic, that was Churchill's description of Mossadegh, in a bizarre faraway country, which is the way the British government perceived Iran, would have the temerity to stand up and propose such a preposterous suggestion. They thought that Mossadegh was just blackmailing them and he wanted to get a few extra million, just like corrupt leaders in the past had done. But it soon became clear to the British that Mossadegh was in deadly earnest, and that the enormous majority of the Iranian people supported him. There had never, in the modern history of Iran, been any political program that had been so fervently and passionately supported by the Iranian people as the nationalization of the oil company. So soon the British understood that this was a very serious challenge. So how did they respond? Very simple. According to their long experience in the world, they decided, we will invade Iran and take back the oil fields. They actually produced two different invasion plans. One was to take over all of Iran, and the other was to take over just the oil fields and their refinery. The British had built the world's largest refinery at Abadan in the Persian Gulf. Well, as the plans were underway, President Truman found out what was happening. He went crazy when he heard this, and he told the British in no uncertain terms, this is out of the question. We cannot possibly tolerate the idea here in the modern age of 1950s that Britain will send troops to invade a third world country. This is out of the question. We cannot support it. So this shocked the British. They decided on Plan B. And that plan was they would go to the United Nations, which was then an institution completely responsive to the big powers, and file a resolution, which they would submit for the endorsement of the Security Council, ordering Mossadegh to return the oil company to its British owners. Now, the Americans in the Truman administration tried in a friendly way to warn the British that maybe this wasn't such a good idea. That maybe when the world heard the British case and the Iranian case, they might not be all sympathetic with the British. But the British, caught up in the colonial mentality that had guided them for so long, brushed aside these protests. They, I think, honestly believed that once the world saw how benevolent and how helpful and how friendly the British had been in Iran, they would naturally embrace the British cause and brush aside the foolish, maniacal desire of this elderly lunatic to nationalize the oil company. Well, things happened just the way the Americans had predicted. When Mossadegh found out that this resolution had been filed at the United Nations and that the British were going to try to use this mechanism to take back their oil company, not only was he not displeased, but he decided that he would personally fly to New York to present the Iranian case. He did this, and he made a tremendous impression in New York. He delivered extremely eloquent speeches at the Security Council, some of which I quote at some length in my book. After his presentation, the Security Council was so impressed that it rejected, really for the first time in the history of the UN, a proposal from one of the big powers. And in classic diplomatic fashion, they did not disapprove the British resolution, but they approved a resolution that called for the postponement of this question until a certain date or indefinitely. Wonderful diplomatic phrase. Okay, that plan didn't work either. Now the British are going on to Plan C. You can't invade. The UN will not help you. Fine. We'll arrange a coup, we'll overthrow Mossadegh, and we'll put someone in who will be friendly and will give us back our oil company. The problem was that Iran in those days, very much like Iran today actually, for a country of many millions, is actually a very small town. Everybody knows what everybody else is doing. And when British agents started contacting Iranian officers and Iranian politicians to help them in their coup, Mossadegh immediately got news of this. He did the only thing that he could have done to protect himself. He closed the British embassy. He sent all the British diplomats home, and among them were all the secret agents who were going to plan the coup. So now the British were really in a fix. They had lost their oil company, which was really the foundation of their entire economic prosperity. They could not invade. The United Nations had not supported them, and now they couldn't even overthrow the guy who was tormenting them. They were stymied, and they were tremendously frustrated. In November of 1952, a huge surge of excitement charged through the British Foreign Office and the Secret Service with the news from America that a new administration had been elected in the United States. It was the election of Eisenhower, the change of government in the United States, that electrified the British and made them think, maybe we can get this done after all. They had appealed to President Truman to organize a coup for them, but President Truman had refused. He told them, the CIA has never overthrown a government. This is not what the CIA is about. This is not what the CIA is for. The United States doesn't want to go off in this direction. We don't want to set this precedent. But the Eisenhower administration and the officials who were about to take office, particularly John Foster Dulles, who would be the incoming Secretary of State, and his brother Allen, who was the incoming CIA director, had a very different view of the world. Truman and Eisenhower really had the same assessment of the communist threat. They both took it extremely seriously. And actually, looking at what was happening at the moment, you could hardly do otherwise. Think what had happened in just the last few years. Most of Eastern Europe had fallen under communist control. The communists had won the civil war in China. Stalin had exploded a nuclear bomb. Communist troops were fighting Americans in Korea. There was no doubt that there was a great global enemy facing the United States. But where Truman and Eisenhower differed was how they decided to confront this threat. Truman's idea, as expressed by his brilliant Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, was that the United States should show the nationalists in Asia and Africa and Latin America that the United States was their true friend. His idea was that Americans should embrace the anti-colonialist, nationalist ideology that was emerging throughout these parts of the world. That fell by the wayside when Eisenhower took office. Richard Nixon, who was Eisenhower's vice president, of course, had accused the previous administration of enrolling the United States in what Nixon called Dean Acheson's College of Cowardly Communist Containment. As a result, the Dulles brothers were anxious to strike out. They wanted to fight back. But who could they fight back against? It was not possible to bomb Moscow. It was not possible to invade China and try to reverse the outcome of the Civil War there. Who could they strike out against? The British were so excited by the result of the 1952 election that they couldn't even wait until Eisenhower was inaugurated to get their project going. Only a couple of weeks after the election, they sent one of their most senior agents, actually a guy that had been the chief of their intelligence station in Tehran before Mossadegh threw him out, to Washington. His mission was make a presentation to the incoming Eisenhower team, to the Dulles brothers and their associates, and see if you can persuade them to do what Truman refused to do. Overthrow this guy for us. Now, this agent later wrote a memoir, which I quote in my book. And in this memoir, he wrote something about this mission. This is what he wrote. I'm paraphrasing now. I knew that if I came to Washington and made our traditional argument, I wouldn't get any response. Our traditional argument was, Mossadegh took away our oil company. Please overthrow him so we can get it back. This was not an argument that excited Americans. And this agent recognized this. He said, I knew I had to come up with another argument. And knowing how these people were thinking, I knew what the argument should be. I would come to Washington and tell them that they should overthrow Mossadegh, not because he took away our oil company, but because he was leading Iran toward communism. Sure enough, that argument electrified the Dulles brothers, who were looking for some place to lash out, and they immediately embraced this idea. Now, the way the coup was carried out was fascinating. One of the things I've always wondered about, and one of the reasons that led me actually to write this book, is this question. How do you go about overthrowing a government? What do you do? Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, was the CIA agent who was sent to Iran with the assignment of overthrowing the democratically elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh. He snuck into Iran and began immediately bribing politicians, bribing newspaper editors, organizing riots in the streets, and in general, trying to throw Iran into chaos. He managed to bribe a number of military officers toward the side of the coup. He hired gang leaders to organize riots. The way that Kermit Roosevelt organized this was really brilliant. He had people writing articles in the press condemning Mossadegh. 4/5 of Iran's newspapers were actually in the pay of the CIA. And those newspapers, day after day, were printing stories about how Mossadegh was a communist, he wanted to destroy the monarchy, he was undermining the Iranian army, and just for good measure, since they were capital crimes in Iran, he was a Jew and a homosexual. And these articles were printed the next day in papers that were under the control of the CIA. In fact, these papers were so eager to print whatever the CIA wanted that they didn't even have enough reporters to produce all this stuff. And the CIA actually had people here in the United States, in Washington, writing these articles and sending them to Iran by plane. That's how they had to do it in those days. And the next day, these articles would appear in the press. In addition to this, and the bribing of the military officers and religious leaders who began preaching against Mossadegh from their pulpits, he decided he needed to organize public conflicts that would show ordinary people that Iran was drifting into chaos. So he hired a mob and gave them a very curious assignment. And of course, most of the people in this mob had no idea that they were being paid by the CIA. It was only a couple of the people at the top who had received money, and they themselves may even not have known where it came from. This is the assignment. He assigned this mob of several thousand people to surge through the main streets of Tehran, beat up anyone they saw on the street, smash shop windows, fire guns into mosques, and shout pro-Mossadegh slogans. We love Mossadegh and communism. Long live People's Republic of Iran. Then he hired another mob to attack this mob so that street fighting would break out and give people the impression that Iran was slipping completely into anarchy. This was very successful. Now, how was Kermit Roosevelt going to strike the final blow? The plan was this. Late one night, around midnight, an officer who had been brought into the plot would arrive at Mossadegh's house with a military detail and a document signed by the Shah, dismissing Mossadegh from office. This was a document of very dubious legality, since in democratic Iran, a phrase which is even very hard for us to contemplate at this moment, democratic Iran, only the parliament could hire and fire prime ministers. Mossadegh would certainly protest upon receiving this decree. When he protested, he would be arrested. And the next day, the CIA's man would be appointed to replace him. So what happened? On the fateful night of August 15th, 1953, this colonel showed up with his men at Mossadegh's house, presented the decree, and suddenly, out of the shadows, emerged other military units loyal to Mossadegh. The coup had been betrayed. Mossadegh had found out what was afoot. And the man who was supposed to arrest Mossadegh was himself arrested. The coup had failed. This was a disaster for the CIA. And in fact, the CIA officers in Washington were so frightened that they sent Kermit Roosevelt an urgent cable and told him, you better get out very quickly, because if they ever find out that you're there, they'll shoot you immediately. Now, this was a time when CIA agents operated mainly by their wits. They didn't have moment-to-moment contact with anyone in Washington. There was no technology that allowed that. Kermit Roosevelt decided to ignore that cable. And he sent another one back to Washington saying, you know something, I think I can still do this. You sent me over here to overthrow this guy. I'm still going to get it done. I'm going to come up with another plan. I detail this at great length in my book, so I won't do it again now, but the short of it is, 4 days later, Kermit Roosevelt struck a second time. And Mossadegh was really disarmed. Why? Mossadegh and his cabinet ministers and advisors believed that the coup attempt of August 15th had been organized by the Shah. Now, the moment that coup failed, the Shah fled, displaying the courage for which he was always known. He disappeared on the morning of the 16th, landing in Baghdad and then later going on to Rome and telling people that he was looking for work, since he was obviously not going to be able to go back to Iran anytime soon. The foreign minister in the Mossadegh government, Hussein Fatemi, made a wonderful speech about him, addressing the Shah, who was then already in exile, saying, "Oh, traitor Shah, you evil person. The moment you woke up and heard over the voice of Tehran that your coup had failed, you fled to the nearest country where Britain has an embassy." The Mossadegh government believed the danger was past. They had no idea that there existed a person like Kermit Roosevelt who was plotting against them from inside the U.S. embassy in Tehran. Therefore, Mossadegh pulled all of his people off the streets. He asked his police not to interfere with protests and naively exposed himself to the blow that was then struck on the 19th. During that day, the streets of Iran were in upheaval. Gangs of civilians, later backed by corrupted military units, attacked government buildings. The climactic gun battle happened at Mossadegh's house, where 100 people were killed in the battle. At the end of the night, Mossadegh's house was in flames. Mossadegh had fled, and the coup had succeeded. So August 19th, 1953, was the day on which the CIA did something it had never done before. It overthrew a foreign leader. Mossadegh turned himself in a few days later. He was put on trial for treason by the new regime, now directed by the Shah, who had returned. And the Shah actually had been sitting in a restaurant in his hotel in Rome when he got the news. Foreign correspondents brought him excitedly these cables from Tehran telling him the coup has now succeeded. He was naturally in great shock. And his first reaction after recovering his wits was to say, "I knew it! They love me!" He flew back to Tehran. Mossadegh was imprisoned for the next 3 years and spent the rest of his life in house arrest. And the United States believed it had won a great victory. Now, at the time, of course, that coup seemed like a complete success. At relatively low cost, the United States had overthrown a government that it didn't like and brought back the Shah, who was obviously now prepared to do America's bidding. It was a perfect success, or so it seemed at the time. It is only now, from the perspective of 50 years, that we are able to look back and see the horrific long-term consequences that this apparent success actually produced for us. What were these long-term effects? This coup placed the Shah back on his throne. The Shah ruled with increasing repression, and his dictatorship ultimately produced the explosion of the late 1970s that we know of as the Islamic Revolution. That revolution brought to power a group of fanatically anti-American clerics who proceeded to launch a murderous campaign of terror against the United States and other Western powers. This regime also inspired radical fundamentalists in a number of other Muslim countries, including next door Afghanistan, where the Taliban came to power and gave sanctuary to Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It is not far-fetched to draw a line from the 1953 coup through the Shah's repressive regime and the Islamic Revolution to the fireballs that engulfed the World Trade Center on September 11th. When we ask ourselves why this happened, and how the United States got into the position it's now in, we cannot answer that without looking back at what happened in 1953. Now, imagine what might have happened if the United States had found a way to embrace and support the Mossadegh government and, by extension, democracy in Iran. This was the Truman policy. Actually, Truman was very frustrated and irritated with Mossadegh, who refused to compromise with him. But he realized that he would have to live with Mossadegh. This was something that the Eisenhower administration refused to accept. We would have sent a message throughout the Middle East that the United States supports democracy in this region. Instead, we sent the opposite message. We sent a message to a whole generation of people throughout the Middle East that the United States wants strongman rule in the Middle East. We don't want democracy that produces student demonstrations and anti-American groups and leftist political parties and student protests. We want strongman rule that will support us in our international confrontation with the Soviets and guarantee us access to the resources of the region, which is a nice code word for oil. This message was heard very clearly throughout the entire Middle East. And that is one of the reasons why the Middle East came to be dominated by tyrants. It was because the emerging generation of the 1950s and 60s understood what the United States wanted. Now, we look back on this episode as an example of the unintended consequences of intervention abroad. I think it's very interesting to look back at Harry Truman and see why it was that he refused the British appeal to stage the coup in Iran. It was not because he was an expert in the Middle East. Harry Truman never pretended to know anything about the Middle East. In fact, it was exactly his ignorance that led him to be reluctant, that led him to refuse this appeal. He thought to himself, we don't know anything about this country, and if we intervene so violently in its political development, this is going to produce consequences that we're not even imagining. I wish that that very clever realization still was in force in the United States today. Let me talk in conclusion a little bit about the similarities between the Iran operation of 1953 and what we have just gone through in Iraq. First of all, let me say there are some obvious differences. I would think of two in particular. First of all, The Iran operation was a covert operation, and the Iraq operation was a military invasion. And secondly, the target of our wrath, the man we overthrew in Iraq, was a monstrous tyrant. The man we overthrew in Iran was a democratically elected leader who really embraced everything that the United States stands for. After Mossadegh had finished his speeches at the United Nations, he went to Philadelphia so he could visit the Liberty Bell. He was photographed with his hand on that famous crack, and he made a speech there saying, "Our whole policy is to imitate 175 years later what you Americans did. You overthrew the British in order to achieve control over your own destiny. We are only following your noble example." Now, those differences aside, let's look at some of the similarities between these operations. In the first place, neither Iran in 1953 or Iraq in 2003 posed an imminent threat to the United States. Both of these were operations of choice. They were not necessary to protect the immediate national security of the United States. Secondly, both of them had to do in large measure with oil. It is, of course, completely naive to believe that any foreign power ever intervenes in the Middle East without thinking about oil. The Americans, in the back of their mind, were very interested in obtaining a stake in Iranian oil, just as they are today in Iraqi oil. After the coup happened, actually, in 1953, the British came back to Washington and told Eisenhower, "You know, we're so happy, we're so grateful, thank you so much for getting us back our oil company." Of course, then the Eisenhower administration said, "Not so fast. Wait just a minute now. We did all the dirty work. We should get some of the benefit." And the agreement that was reached afterwards was that instead of the British getting 100% of the foreign shares in Iranian oil, they'd only get 40%. And American companies would get 40%, surprise, surprise. And a few other European countries would get the rest. So oil was also a factor that tied them both together. Another factor they have in common is that in both cases, in both the Iran operation of 1953 and the Iraq operation of recent times, the United States felt that it was striking back against a global enemy. Now, as I said earlier, it was not possible in 1953 for the United States to strike back against its real enemies. That would have produced cataclysm. So the United States had to look around for somewhere that it could make some statement, that an attack against some country that would seem like an enemy. It was the same thing that happened in Iraq. We were not able to do what had to be done to capture the people who had actually been responsible for the horrific attack on our people. So we looked around for someone else we could attack. The Afghanistan operation didn't satisfy us in our desire for revenge, and Iraq became the focus. So in both cases, we were unable to attack a real enemy, so we attacked one that seemed real. Another similarity was the twisting of intelligence information. An American scholar about 10 or 15 years ago did a wonderful research project. He found the two CIA agents and one State Department diplomat who were posted in the U.S. Embassy in Iran in 1953 and whose job it was to monitor leftist and communist movements in Iran. And he interviewed all three of these guys, and they all told him, "We routinely exaggerated the strength of the Communist Party and the influence of anti-American groups in Iran because we knew that's what the people back in Washington wanted to hear." Flash forward 50 years, we see the children and grandchildren, spiritually anyway, of these agents telling us that the hundreds of tons of chemical weapons that Saddam had amassed were the justification for our invasion. We sent a message in 1953 to our own intelligence community, and the message was, "Don't write what you see. Write what you know we want to hear." This is a very pernicious and dangerous message that I think the American intelligence community learned very well. We can go on and on and pick out similarities, but I think there's one that's probably the most important of all. We were so anxious for a short-term success that we brushed aside all warnings that a short-term success might be followed by terrible long-term consequences. Now, last summer, I made a trip to Iran. I wanted to see what was left of Mossadegh's legacy. I wanted to visit all the buildings and all the places in Iran that he knew, but because Tehran has become so overbuilt in the last couple of decades, it was impossible to find many places. I found a couple. But it was possible to talk to ordinary Iranians about Mossadegh, and I was very interested to find out, after 50 years when it has been more or less forbidden to speak positively or write openly about him, what they knew about him. So I arrived at the hotel in Tehran, curious about what my reception would be there. I arrived at the hotel desk. It's a huge hotel, formerly the Intercontinental in Tehran. And the desk clerk said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Kinzer, we have your room ready. It's room 911. At first, I smiled, but after a minute or two, I said to the guy, "You know, this isn't really funny. Why don't you get me some other room?" He said, "No, I'm sorry. This is the room that I have been told to give you." So I went up there. I called the Iranian journalist with whom I had worked on previous assignments in Iran. I told her, "I'll come here. I want you now to see if you can call up a few people that I can talk to, and we'll get our project going." An hour later, I got a phone call from the travel agent in California who had helped me arrange my trip. It was then like 3 o'clock in the morning in California. And she said, "What are you doing over there?" I said, "What? I'm not doing anything." She said, "I've just gotten a call from the Ministry of Security in Tehran, and they say that someone that I sent over there as a tourist is actually here spying and stirring up trouble and asking questions about Mossadegh." Obviously, the telephone room 911 was not as private as I would have liked. And then this woman journalist with whom I was working called me and said, "I can't work with you. They've told me I'll lose my permission to work in Iran forever if I do anything with you. You can't interview anyone, and they've asked me to tell you that if you try to interview anyone on this subject, you will be immediately expelled." I had gone in, it's true, on a tourist visa after many months of trying to get a journalist visa. So I decided to try to proceed with my tourist program. I went off to Isfahan, magnificent old Iranian city, and after about 3 days of seeing the great sights, I came back to the hotel in Tehran. Oddly enough, the only room vacant in the hotel again was room 911. I met with my guide. American tourists in Iran have to have a guide. And I told him, "I want to go to Mossadegh's village, Ahmadabad. I want you to take me out there on August 19th, it's the day after tomorrow, on the 49th anniversary of the coup. I want to be in Mossadegh's house." And he said, "It's impossible." "Why is it impossible?" "You're here as a tourist," he told me. "The tourism ministry has a list of about 500 places in Iran where tourists can go. Ahmadabad is not on that list. Nobody has ever asked to go to Ahmadabad." Well, I told him, "That doesn't sound like a good enough reason for me. I mean, if it's a town and there's nothing secret going on there, why can't you take me?" He said, "Out of the question." I said, "No, you got to take me there." I tried to insist. Well, to make a long story short, the next night, that was the night of the 18th, he came back with the news that, yes, after our great trouble, he had managed to get permission for us to go to Ahmadabad. We drove out there. It's about an hour or two from Tehran. And we found Mossadegh's house. It's the only big house in the village. We knocked on the gate. We were admitted by a caretaker. And there I was, in the house where Mossadegh spent the last 10 years of his life, enclosed in these four walls. I went into the room where Mossadegh used to receive the few visitors that he was allowed, and the room under which he is now buried. It's surrounded by photographs of Mossadegh and drawings of Mossadegh that have been brought by admirers of his. One of them has a great quote from one of his speeches. As an Iranian and a Muslim, I resolutely oppose anything that is against Iran or Islam. And then I walked around the grounds for a while. Leaning against the back wall of the compound, I saw something remarkable, and I went over to look at it. It was a metal gate. Not a gate that was part of the wall, but a gate that was just from some other place leaning against the wall. I slowly realized that this was the gate of Mossadegh's house in Tehran, the house that had been burned down on the night of the coup. The family had taken the gate, the only thing that had survived, and brought it here and propped it up. How much history this gate has seen. How many world leaders came through this gate to meet Mossadegh. This was the gate through which angry mobs paid by foreign intelligence officers had smashed through in a famous episode when the great CIA-sponsored gang leader Shaban the Brainless had led an attack on Mossadegh's house. Sure enough, there was a big dent in the bottom of the gate. I put my hand on this gate. I held it there for a long time and felt that, again, as I felt while Mossadegh's portrait was looking down at me while I was writing this book, that I was somehow in touch with the legacy that he had left. Now, although there were very few buildings left from the Mossadegh time, I knew that Mossadegh must have left some kind of a spiritual or political legacy. And although I was not permitted to interview any officials, I certainly could talk to ordinary people that I met, and I did. And I asked every one of them the same question. What do you know or what do you think about Mohammad Mossadegh? And I got two answers. The first answer that everybody gave me was, he nationalized the oil. Everybody knows that. And the second answer I got from a lot of people was, there was democracy then. You could say what you believed, not like now. And that is why today Mossadegh is a hidden, eerie threat hanging over the Islamic regime. It is illegal in Iran today to support the establishment of any regime other than an Islamic regime in Iran. But when you hold up Mossadegh's picture, that's just what you're doing. You don't need any phrase or any word under the picture. When you just hold up his picture, you are saying, I don't like this regime, I believe in democracy. Democracy is going to return to Iran. It was very clear to me when I was there that 80% of the people in Iran detest their regime. I wouldn't go so far as to predict when or how this will happen, but the time will come. And when it does, not only will that house in Ahmadabad become a museum and a pilgrimage site, but the picture of Mohammad Mossadegh, this titanic figure from mid-century who has now been all but lost to history, will be hanging on the wall in every government office and in every public building. And it will mark the triumph of something that the United States shamefully tried to prevent, but something that really should be our great goal, and that is to allow Iran to follow the path that we followed and finally embrace the ideals of democracy and allow the Iranian people, finally, after 50 years of frustration brought about by our coup, to shape their own destiny. Thank you very much. Another brave man, they'll take the money and spread it out equal, just like.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.